Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and today's show is titled Out-of-Body Experiences. Please note that all the chat board questions will be answered next week on the chat board, as well as posted on my website within a day or so of the show. We encourage and welcome your questions. One of the most unusual aspects of spirituality is the out-of-body experience. This is when our consciousness leaves the confines of our body and travels to other locations. As strange as this may sound, both the U.S. and Soviet Union governments sponsored research in this area during the Cold War with some amazing results. Indeed, this may be the easiest way to convince skeptics that consciousness can and does exist outside the body, because it should be able to be verified when done under strict controls. Our guest today is Luis Manero, author of Demystifying the Out-of-Body Experience, a practical manual for exploration and personal evolution. Mr. Manero has taught courses on out-of-body experiences for 20 years in Europe and the Americas. He is currently the education director of the International Academy of Consciousness Global. Luis Manero, welcome to the show, Luis.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, it's great to have you with us. I read your book and really, really enjoyed it. A lot of interesting stuff there. I would encourage any of our listeners who are interested in the subject to look at it. Again, it's Demystifying the Out-of-Body Experience, and we're going to talk about that book here today. To start out, why don't you just explain, what is an out-of-body experience?
Yeah, of course. An out-of-body experience happens most of the times while people are sleeping. They disconnect from their physical body. And this other aspect of themselves, let me call it this, their consciousness, their soul, remains aware, remains lucid, and can have a real experience outside their body, both sometimes in the physical reality or sometimes in other planes of existences. And then afterwards, the person can return to their physical body and can remember such an experience and can, share it with other people, analyze it, etc.
How often do people have this? I mean, most people would say, I don't have an out-of-body experience when I sleep. I just go to sleep. I may have some odd dreams, but I don't have an out-of-body experience. How often does this happen to people, and how many people does it happen to?
Yeah, indeed. It's not a common occurrence. I would say it's a minority, and depending on the story that you read, this happens more or less between 1% of the population to maybe like around 5 or 7% of the population. And even when it happens, let's say, to 5% of the population, it doesn't mean that it happens every night, but it more than anything means that it has happened to them. And so maybe it has happened in the course of their life a couple of times or so. What is interesting about them is that, of course, when people have them, this is something that makes a very... they are very hard to forget. They're very, very memorable, obviously, because it's a very different experience from a dream or from any other type of paranormal phenomena.
Okay, so you'd remember this. You wouldn't. This isn't something that you have to. If you have one of these when you're asleep and you wake up in the morning, a dream, you have to. Well, if you don't write it down within the first 15, 20 seconds, you're pretty much unless it's really emotional, you probably. Pretty much don't remember it. But you're saying this, you would remember this afterwards.
Well, the complexity is such that, actually several people have had them and they just don't remember it. And I say that because we see it with our students all over the world, that many times they are, in the middle of the classes or afterwards, they have developed very well their skills. And once they are outside their body, they remember that they had, for example, a similar out-of-body experience many years ago when they were maybe 15 years old. And during this entire time, that memory just never got to the brain, so to speak, and now they're able to remember it because they're in the same environment where the memory of that prior experience is at. And now they're able to come back with a recollection of both of the experience that they had when they were 15, as well as with the current experience.
Okay. So you teach people to have these out-of-body experiences. Why would someone want to have one?
Good question. There are actually many, many reasons. And people actually, I would say, even have a lot of different types of objectives. But many people just... going with the basics, many people sometimes they want to develop them because they want to find out or they want to make contact with these other more evolved and benign beings that we call usually of spirit guides, even though we have given them a lot of names, masters, angels, illuminated beings, etc., etc. Other individuals, sometimes their main purpose for developing their out-of-body experiences is meeting relatives who have already passed away. Just to make sure that they are okay, something that it's feasible, certainly in an out-of-body experience. Other individuals, they do it because they want to find out more information about their life purpose or their life task. What we observe is that, before being born, many individuals, they plan their main projects or their main tasks for this physical life. And then in an out-of-body experience, we can find out information about, in essence, what our initial intention was before deciding to come into this first place, meaning what was it that we wanted to accomplish. Other individuals, they do it because they want to lose the fear of death. Other individuals, they do it because they want to, be outside the body and visit different places. Others, because they want to understand much better the spiritual planes, which is actually a very spiritual thing to do, to very directly get to know the spiritual planes where we were before being born, and I guess where we're going to come back after we pass away as well. So really there are quite a number of reasons why people many times they want to accomplish this.
Do you think it helps people to evolve spiritually by having a out-of-body experience?
Indeed, that is one of the main one of the main topics, one of the main objectives, and certainly one of the ones that we focus more on, just simply because we acquire a much larger perspective. We understand that we are much more than just simply this current life. We understand much better where we're coming from. So you see, when individuals have an out-of-body experience, they pretty much end up having the same effects on themselves, in their personality, in their being. The same effect that people who have a near-death experience describe, that usually when people have a near-death experience and they come back, they describe how they themselves, they are a better person, they are more humane, they try to help other people more. Again, they have a larger perspective, they lose the fear of death, they become more grounded, more open, more authentic, really quite a number of effects and benefits, really. And that happens as well with the out-of-body experiences.
Yeah. Now that brings up the type of experiences. And you call them projections. I guess an OBE or out-of-body experience and a projection is really the same thing, right?
Sure, exactly, yes.
Okay. Now, you say that there's three types of projections or out-of-body experiences. What are those three types?
Yes, in the way it can be induced, or according to how they begin, it can be the spontaneous out-of-body experience, which is what most people have, the involuntary one, just simply in the middle of the night. We wake up outside of our body. Usually people describe how they woke up, floating close to the ceiling or close to the wall. And usually the spontaneous out-of-body experiences, they also tend to be short. Maybe they last 5 or 10 seconds, and the person comes back into their body. Normally, even they come back into their body fairly quickly because people were just simply not expecting to be in that situation. And the fact that they become aware of that surprises them. And that brings us back into our physical body. But it's a very memorable moment, more or less like when people have a lucid dream. that I'm sure that even the listeners that are listening to us, you know, when we have a lucid dream, that moment in which we realize that we are aware, lucid, and dreaming, usually tends to be short for most people. Tends to be maybe 5 seconds or 10 seconds of awareness. And then after that, you know, normally the level of awareness drops down into the normal dream. But what we remember later on were those 5 or 10 seconds. And sometimes we remember them years, decades afterwards that we had such an experience.
Okay, so that's one. That's the spontaneous.
That's one indeed. The second one is the forced out-of-body experience, where the main thing that fits in here is the near-death experience. So where people are forced outside their body, they were not trying to have it, but they're forced outside their body, in this case because of a heart attack, an accident, you know, in the middle of a surgery, etc. And then, of course, you know, you have the classical account of the near-death experience where people describe again that they are looking at their physical body. In this case, they're seeing, you know, the nurses, the doctors working on their physical body, trying to resuscitate them. Then most people describe a light. They end up following this light or a tunnel of light, and they end up going through this tunnel, and they arrive at some other dimension, situation, condition, hard to put a name, you know, to where they arrive. And when they arrive at this other side, there is usually a group of people there to meet them or to greet them. And they recognize certain relatives of theirs that had already passed away, as well as many times there is somebody who is in charge of the little group and who ends up doing most of the talking. And this tends to be their spirit guide. And in essence, the spirit guide tells them, you know, sometimes in few words, it's not your time. Go back. And they find themselves going through right. the tunnel and, you know, just returning to their physical body. So that would be the second kind. And then okay. the third kind is the one that is the induced at will. So you can produce it, you can provoke it, and you can learn how to do this. This is we say that this is a skill like any other skill that we might have developed in our life. It's in essence, you know, a matter of receiving some information, applying some effort, and the capacity goes on developing little by little.
Okay. Now, when you have one of these out-of-body experiences, you know, how do your perceptions change? And let's start out with the visual. You know, right now we have a visual view of about, I don't know, 120 or so degrees peripheral and maybe up and down 90 degrees or whatever. What do you have? Is that the same when you're in your out-of-body experience?
No, what tends to happen, or at least it can be much greater. Let's put it that way. The so-called astral body, let me call it this at this moment, just because probably if listeners have read a book or have heard about the topic, that's probably the most common name that that people have used. So our astral body has a much larger way of perceiving things. So the area in which we are perceiving is much greater than just simply this, you know, this frontal vision that we all usually are used to and enjoy of 110, 120 degrees and more or less 90 degrees up and down. But in essence, outside the body, you can be aware enough to be able to perceive and to see, you know, almost like throughout your entire skin. Some authors actually call this of dermic vision, precisely because it seems that our entire skin is perceiving and seeing. So, and this can even give us a reference of how much more awareness we can have outside the body. When we consider, for example, how it is to be able to just simply digest images that are coming at us, you know, and we are perceiving them throughout our entire body.
Right. That's kind of amazing. I've heard that too. From other people that have had near-death experience, that they've said that they have like, you know, virtually spherical vision, which it's hard to imagine, really.
Indeed. But that tends to happen.
Okay.
And
how about the other senses?
The other senses as well, you know, just like, for example, even coming back to vision, just like we can have a spherical vision, at the same time, we can displace our vision, you know, to see something that is very far away. And then with regards to the other senses, the same thing occurs. It seems that you can receive input coming from any direction. With vision, it becomes more evident. But at the same time, you can have remote sensing. So you can, you know, be smelling, for example, I don't know what, in my case, my mother actually lives in Florida. So when I am outside my body, I can displace my sense of smell and, you know, smell what she's cooking back in the East Coast, even though my astral body is still here on the West Coast. So and the same thing happened with remote hearing and, you know, remote vision, remote viewing, that is actually the term that we use, remote right. sensing, remote tasting. So we can also displace our senses of perception when we are outside the body.
What's the most interesting OBE experience that you have? Is there one that is more, you know, that stands out for you?
You know, that there becomes more or less like, you know, if we were to ask, I guess, different people, you know, what has been the most memorable day. After a while, especially, we have had several.
Right.
But some of the ones that probably stand out a little bit more are the out-of-body experiences where you arrive at the realities where you were between lives and where you are able to see the activities that go on there, in which people are planning their life task or they're preparing their life task. And, you know, what we observe, I'm not the only one to have seen this, but is that many times individuals during their in-between life periods, I'm sorry, they are participating in certain courses of preparation. Many times we call them intermissive courses, sort of like the courses that we take in this intermission, you know, between two physical lives. In essence, they're just simply like preparatory courses, like a school, basically, that is preparing you for the next life. And there are so many different types of courses that we can participate in. And then,
can you give us an example of some of those courses? I mean, it's fascinating to
Sure. For example, there are courses, you know, to study the body that we're using right now, the physical body. But there are courses to study the astral body, or courses to study the energetic body or the energetic system. You know that interestingly enough, the Western medicine, you know, bases itself a little bit more on the physical body. Of course, this is the approach, right, to try to tackle, you know, any ailment directly through the physical body. But Oriental medicine, you know, acupuncturists, they base themselves a little bit more on the energetic system to try to tackle the ailments or the illnesses that we have, you know, by putting the energetic system in good health. And certainly has a tradition that is even longer, you know, than Western medicine. So some people are studying that, you know, in between life, you know, how does the energetic system work? Besides that, people sometimes they're studying other aspects that seem to be very related to evolution or the evolution of the soul, evolution of the consciousness. Like, for example, how to be more assistential, how to be more ethical, more correct in our behavior, something that goes very much hand in hand with our spiritual development. At the same time, you know, how to be something that the word that we use is how to be more universalistic, which basically what it means is, you know, how to have a larger perspective and not to have too many preconceptions. Us naturally, because of our physical life, you know, we are born in a specific place, in a specific country, we learn a specific language, sometimes we're raised in a specific religion, and then naturally we tend to have that viewpoint, that perspective, that we are that, you know. So in my case, I had a very Western education, a very classic education, so just going only by my physical education, you know, I should think like a Western individual, and, you know, my country should be, or the country where I have spent most of the time should be the best, and I am a physical being. But what happens when you start having out-of-body experiences, and also the same thing happens with people who have near-death experiences, is that you start to acquire a perspective that is a lot larger, and that you are more, instead of just a citizen of one country in one planet, you many times have heard this expression. I have heard it from several other people as well, how they say we are citizens of the universe. And you feel that way because you have even, you know, seen many different things across across the universe. So that perspective of, you know, being universalistic is also something that people studied in between their life. And you're right. I think that those these types of experiences are some of the most fascinating. Just it gives you such a sense of organization when you are, you know, in an out-of-body experience, observing the fact that there are these classes that prepare you. They give you such a sense of, you know, there is a system,
you know,
that we are going
through, clearly.
That is educating us, that is organizing us,
right.
And things are just not random, and we are, you know, random individuals bouncing off of each other, trying to do the best we can, I guess. But it's a very different perspective.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Now you talk about that. So clearly, between lives, we're preparing for another life, and you talk about that a good bit in your book. And so why don't you talk about it? You use the word existential program. I use the word life plan, but it's basically the same thing. Why don't you talk a little bit about what that is and how it's created?
Yeah. You know, life plan or life task or life mission, as many times popularly also other people call it. What we see is that this is one of the main objectives why we come to physical life, really, why we are alive. So it's in essence, physical life is sort of like a period of time in which we're going to come down here and experience different things and be challenged to a certain extent and learn different things, you know, that are going to make us, in essence, a better person. You know, again, the evolution of the soul or the evolution of the consciousness. And this existential program or this life plan, we are basically organizing it before being born. So, you know, again, the main tasks that we want to accomplish or the main project or the main lessons in the case of certain people, we are sort of like designing it, you know, and planning it before being born. And we plan different things, you know, basically a lot of different types of details. Like, for example, in this next life, you know, which is the best country for my development in this next life, or what type of experiences do I want to have? For what I need to accomplish in this next life, which gender should I be born in, and that it will be more useful? Obviously, both men and women have their advantages. And, you know, life and the perspective is going to be different depending on the gender that we are born into. So we tend to choose many of these aspects, you know, that are going to help us to learn different things during the course of life. So what happens is that with the out-of-body experience, you observe people, you know, making these decisions, planning this. And then, of course, this is why, you know, through the out-of-body experience also, you can find out what was it that you had planned for yourself, so that, you know, your life makes more sense. And by the way, again, trying to relate this to near-death experiences, this is also why when people come back from a near-death experience, they come back with a greater sense of direction, because usually during the near-death experience, they get a glimpse of what their life plan is. Normally, even in these conversations with their spirit guide, you know, sometimes the spirit guide is telling them, look, remember you wanted to accomplish X. And they even sometimes help them to remember what X was. And then, of course, they come back with, you know, this greater sense of direction. And many times they change, you know, the course of their life. They try to, you know, get involved in tasks that sometimes are more valuable to society, so to speak.
So who creates the life, this life plan? Do we have a lot of say in it, or does somebody lay this thing out for us?
It can happen in both fashions, because what I see, and sometimes I think that I don't remember now if throughout the book I use this example. We look a little bit like a kid going to school, in the sense that one physical life looks like a school day. And at the end of the school day, we don't stay in school, but we go back home. So at the end of the life, we don't stay here in this physical reality, but we go back to these non-physical dimensions. And the idea would be to do the homework for the next school day. And through successive school days, we go on developing and growing and improving. Now, just like the educational system, to a certain extent, just to continue with this simple example, when we are very young, when we are, for example, in first grade or in second grade, in essence, we barely understand the school system, and we basically don't control that much, our homework or what we're going to study or which classes we're taking. So really, we have very little say about what is it that we are studying. I certainly, when I was in second grade, had very little say, and right, much more than that, I didn't even want to go. I remember rebelling a lot against my parents because of that, even hiding under the bed and doing all kinds of things so as not to go. Right. But, when we are in college, for example, we have a lot more say about what we're studying. If we are in a PhD program, for example, we basically have, one, or we are basically deciding 100% the direction in which we want to go and what we want to study. So to a very great extent, it seems to depend on the level of development that the person has already accomplished.
Okay. Now, we get a lot of help in coming up with this life plan. We get help from our spirit guides, and I guess we have multiple spirit guides. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
And then you mentioned that there is, and I believe it's an evolutionologist, the term that you use, which is, yes, a essentially a very high level spirit guide, very high level. Explain a little bit about that spirit.
Yes, the evolutionologist, which basically is just a name to say he's a specialist, he or she, right, or it. They no longer have any gender.
Right.
So they are basically beings who are specialists in evolution, in the evolution of the soul. So, we just simply, very directly, we call them the evolutionologist. And basically, they would be like a high-level helper, exactly, who have a very big perspective of the mechanism of evolution and the development of not just of one person, but, of how an entire society or an entire country, just to try to give an idea, is growing and is developing. And they try to help people to plan their different types of existential programs. So maybe they look a little bit like, the mayor of a city. That is, that at least they shouldn't be concerned just with the pothole that is outside their house, but they are concerned, with the entire city. How is the flow of traffic in the entire city? How is the educational system in the entire city? So they are trying to create opportunities so that everybody in that group has opportunities for growth and for improving themselves. What makes it, of course, somewhat challenging or very challenging in certain cases is that these beings, because they are so developed, they respect a lot our free will. They respect it basically 100%. And then what ends up happening is they will provide the opportunities for people to develop and for people to grow, but the person is the one that has to choose to participate in them or to take advantage of them. So the person, of course, sometimes doesn't realize it or just simply doesn't want it. And then they end up not developing as much as they could have. And that makes it very challenging. So it's, sometimes I say that it would be almost like trying to educate our kids, respecting 100% what they want. And then sometimes they are so young that they don't really know what they want, but you still should respect them, or at least that's what they're doing in essence, and that just simply becomes challenging. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have any kids, so I'm sure many listeners have a lot more experience than me on this, but I have nephews, and what I many times say is when I am babysitting them or when I have to take them to Toys R Us, they want so many things that I just simply am not going to get. So I you know, sort of like end up thinking, I am certainly not going to follow their free will in this situation at all, because they obviously are asking for things that I know that they don't need, and certainly I am not going to get. So that is just simply a challenging condition. But they certainly, you know, they themselves are certainly try to stay on top of things, to try to produce different types of evolutionary opportunities. And I, you know, through the out-of-body experience, is something I many times mentioned, maybe trying to keep my eye on those things. What I realize is that, you know, looking back in, you know, different decades in which I, you know, have obviously already been here in the physical reality, I see a lot more doors and I see a lot more opportunities in my life than the ones I have been able to take advantage of, the ones I have been able to go through. And, you know, so what I realize, you know, sort of like following, I guess, the non-physical story and then seeing the physical story, is that they are very good at doing what they do. Sometimes, at least in my case, I am the one that has a hard time, you know, sort of like keeping up with the rhythm of development that, you know, that they create.
Yeah. We're talking to Luis Manera, the author of Demystifying the Out-of-Body Experience. Have you ever encountered one of these special evolutionist beings that, you know, on any of your out-of-body experiences?
Yes, I have seen them, and you know, usually they are very busy. Let me say that. So I have seen them, and I have seen them precisely, you know, at work, and you know, doing different things at work. I don't know how well that expression translates, but you know, engaged in their activities. In the sense that, you know, I don't want to give the idea that they are there just waiting for us, you know, to leave the body so that we can have, a Kodak moment. They're going to take a selfie with us, you know, and you know, have tea with us for 5 minutes. But they, because they are trying to organize and to help people so much in their development, they really take their task very seriously, I would say, in the sense that, you know, not that they are stressed out, but they are focused on their activities. So sometimes, you know, in 5 minutes that they would sit down to chat with me, let's say, you know, they could be helping 5,000 people. And obviously, you know, helping 5,000 people takes precedence over, you know,
over a chat with yourself.
Yes, over a chat, so that they can, you know, just simply, I don't know, answer questions that I happen to have. But you know, the other thing that I realized that is, to me also, it's an interesting aspect, is that you know, we were describing this evolutionologist as a very high level, high evolved being, you know. Or this spirit guide that has a much more awareness than the, if I can call it this, the average spirit guide. But what ends up happening is that the average spirit guide is already so much more developed, certainly than me, and that, you know, I would say average human beings, that really most of the questions that I have, the average, you know, spirit guide is more than capable enough of answering. So really, these other beings, you know, there is sort of like a hierarchy, and these other beings, in essence, don't need to, you know,
don't need to interface with them that much.
Yeah. Yes, not as much, not as much. So it would be almost like, you know, our teacher in, you know, in middle school compared to the principal, and we, honestly, most of the times don't really need to talk to the principal.
Right.
There is really no need. The teacher already has, you know, pretty much all of the answers.
Right. Where are our life plans stored? I mean, I'm sure they're stored somewhere. Where are they stored?
Well, first of all, we have it. You know, when we leave the body, we realize we have this this astral body. We also have this energetic system, and we also have this.
Subconscious, you think, or is it our mental?
Our mental body. So we have this deposit of memories in our mental body. That has received really a lot of names. We just simply tend to call it integral memory because it's sort of like a memory that is holding or that has stored everything that we have been and everything that we have experienced both in other lives as well as in, you know, in between lives. But, in other ideologies, probably listeners have heard how people refer to the Akashic Records. Maybe this might be a term, that some people might have already heard.
It's right, that's a popular term. Right?
Yeah, indeed. Maybe a little more esoteric, but a little more classic, certainly, right. the expression.
Yep.
And then many of that. So again, in usually in classic literature, I guess they describe it as this, I guess I'm going to use the term, this library that we can go to and, you know, access information about ourselves and about, you know, anything that has occurred in life. And
are those stored within us as well?
Exactly. Well, what pertains to us, yes, what pertains to us, what pertains to our own life, to our own existence, you know, and in between life periods, certainly that is stored in us. And the information that, pertains to other places or to other beings, that information is usually in those places or in those beings. Let's say we want to know, you know, what happened, you know, here in the United States 5,000 years ago. We would have to go to that specific place and sort of like make an energetic reading of the place to be able to know what happened 5,000 years ago. So the information is contained in each one of the places because as we live, we manifest this energetic information and we leave sort of like an imprint of the activity that we were undergoing at that time. And that can be, you know, read in the energetic information later.
So the energetic information never disappears, never goes away.
It doesn't go away, yes. There's always some evidence of what happened there. Actually, in some cases, this can be very, very strong, you know. If, it happened to be an event where a lot more people were involved and a lot more people, you know, were affected by it.
Like a battlefield or something?
Like a battlefield, indeed. Either something, you know, more tragic or more negative, you know, or something more positive. Nowadays, I think about, let's say, a university campus where there are, you know, thousands of people, you know, interested in education and for many decades, you know, if that university ever, you know, disappears, the amount of energetic information that was aggregated there and accumulated there, you know, obviously it makes already a very strong energy field that, you know, it's going to remain for a while in essence. And it's going to be much, much stronger than the energetic field, for example, of one household where only a few people are responsible for that field.
Right. You talk about karma, and you talk about three different kinds of karma. You talk about the ego karma, the group karma, and the poly karma. Interesting. I've never heard karma broken up exactly like that, but it certainly makes sense. Could you talk a little bit about those?
Yes, indeed. And, you know, that classification, in essence, is to try to differentiate between, the scope of that karmic effects. So the ego karma is, you know, the action and reaction of the things that pertain mainly to us, that have a reaction on us, basically and individually. So, for example, things like, health. If we eat well, obviously this has more than anything an impact on us. And if we eat badly, you know, this has an impact mainly on us. So the effect, the consequence of the decision basically is affecting us. Sometimes, obviously, it ends up affecting other people, but mainly it's us. Then we have the group karma, where this is the action and reaction, the cause and effect. with the rest of the group, the rest of the people that we interact directly with. So if we have the tendency to nurture good relationships, then of course, you know, our interaction with the rest of the group is going to tend to be more positive. And if we, you know, nurture relationships that are not as positive for whichever reason, if the way we treat other people, you know, is not as positive, then the tendency is going to be that the reaction, you know, coming towards us is not going to be as positive as well. So the scope would be the people that we have direct interactions with.
And so you'd look at that maybe as a team, for example, and you'd say, you know, every once in a while, take the Miami Dolphins in. I forget
okay.
what they were. they won all the games, and nobody didn't seem to have any superstars or very many superstars anyway. I guess they had some, but all of a sudden they seem to be working together in an unusually high level of organization and accomplishment. So that would be the type of thing that you're talking about here. Is that what you're saying?
You know, certainly in the case of a team, yes, they're going to form part of the same group karma. But for example, our family, you know, our coworkers, obviously we realize that if we tend to treat them with more respect and everything, normally we're going to get that back as well. So there we start to create this tendency. So, and what happens in terms of karma, again, is action and reaction, is that let's say if we tend to be available for whenever people are in a critical situation or a critical juncture in their lives, then normally the moment that we are in a critical juncture ourselves, you know, they normally tend to be available to help us as well. So there is this sort of like a feedback effect, you know, this consequence, you know, from that. So yes, teams, family, coworkers, okay. Our neighbors, you know, that we tend to have more contact with, etc. So this would be the group karma. And okay. then the third type, the polykarma, is what pertains with the rest of humanity. So and normally, I even say, you know, we normally don't have such an impact on the rest of humanity. Not normally, most people don't. But this applies especially in the case, let's say, you know, a radio host where the show is listened to, you know, all over the world, and they have a very big audience. You know, whatever is said on the show, if it happens to be more constructive, more positive, then, you know, what the person is getting in terms of benefits back is also tends to be more constructive and positive, and they associate with people that are more positive and constructive. But if the show is a little bit more, I don't know, more radical, more destructive, more about complaining, I don't know, about different challenges or issues that we have in the world, then, you know, what tends to happen, of course, is that's the type of individuals that we associate with. Naturally. To give another example, we can think of a doctor who finds the cure for a specific disease. Sometimes the disease, nobody in his family has it or in his state, but all of a sudden, you know, in the other side of the world, in Tanzania, you know, 2 million people in Tanzania get vaccinated. And that is just simply like putting a very positive, you know, or having a very positive effect, you know, on humanity at large, that to a certain extent, we don't know if in another life that doctor is going to be born closer to that group. And then the positive effect of that, you know, action that they produced at this moment, it comes back and return. So the polykarma.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. Death. You talk about death, and you talk about you refer to it more as a deactivation, which is probably a better term if you think about the word, because death isn't really death. It's kind of the death of the body, but it's not real death. And you talk about a deactivation, and you talk about various levels of it, level 1, 2, 3, eventually. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, and this is, I also think, is very interesting, because naturally, you know, when we have let's say, just a physical perspective, or when we believe that we are just simply the physical body, naturally we are concerned with the, you know, with how the physical body is going to cease to exist, or what we call the biological death. But when we start having out-of-body experiences or with more paranormal phenomena, we realize that we have these other vehicles of manifestation as well, these other bodies that we can use for our manifestation. So besides the physical body, we have the energetic body, the astral body, I'm here using the more popular terms, and the mental body. So, and then, of course, we come across this reality that not only the physical body can cease to exist, but the other ones too. So we can go through these other deactivations or transitions, or to put it in popular terms, the death of not only the physical body, but also the energetic body and the astral body, and so on. So in this, we realize that certainly, you know, individuals, as they go through the biological death or the deactivation of the physical body, they many times can go only through the deactivation of the physical body, or they can go through more of these transitions. And in essence, one of these transitions, or any of these transitions, would be almost like, again, like a transition from a state of greater restriction to a state of lesser restriction, where we can enjoy more awareness and we can go further and understand more things. So I sometimes put it along those lines so that we, first of all, to try to diminish the fear with regards to the transition, and to try to encourage the exploration of these other realms or these other places even beforehand, so that we don't have such a hesitation or such a fear, because this transition will happen eventually, right? But certainly they are interesting in and of themselves, because once the person starts undergoing several of these transitions, the level of awareness that they enjoy and understanding that they enjoy, you know, is just simply much greater in terms of themselves and of the universe and of, you know, this evolutionary endeavor that we seem to be embedded in.
We don't have time to go into all the details on this, but you do a very good job on this in your book. And I would encourage the listeners, if you're interested in this subject and really any of the other ones, to get your hands on this copy of the book, Demystifying the Out-of-Body Experience. Don't get intimidated by a couple of the large words in it. One, they make sense if you think about them. Two, he's got a glossary in it. And three, he ends up explaining them also in the more the natural terms that one you're using today, Lewis. But it's a fascinating book. And you know what I liked about the book is that you didn't have to read it from front to back. You could jump around and read sections where you wanted, and you explained enough of it so you'd understand that section. Then you go back, and I ended up reading it all. But you can read what is interesting to you and learn about what's interesting to you in the process. Very, very well done book, I thought.
Yeah, no, thank you. And certainly that was the intention, you know. And one thing that I mentioned that is interesting is that you know, or now we live in such a day and age, now in the 21st century, that the out-of-body experience certainly can become a very key tool for tying up a lot of other ideas and things, sometimes from our cultures and from religions that we had already, you know, observed and seen. But this helps us to put it in a very, you know, coherent, organized fashion, and to have very direct experience, you know, that goes along with all this other information from different books and things that probably many of us had already read, and they had stayed sort of like at an informational level. And now we can have, you know, again, direct experience and evidence of some of these, many of the things.
Yeah. Why don't you, we only have about a minute left. Why don't you talk about, you know, how people can get in touch with you, and you have this International Academy of Consciousness. Just a short discussion on that.
Sure. The IAC, the International Academy of Consciousness, we're a fairly large or spread out organization of research and of education. And one of our main activities is we teach and we give classes so that people can develop their own skills. And maybe one of the best ways to contact us is this website, learn learnobes.com. It's basically the website of the book, you know, learnobes.com. So OBE is for out-of-body experiences, of course. And but once you go to that website, you will also see on the left-hand side, you know, links to the different cities and the different places where we give classes, not just in English, but in different languages all over the world. And we also offer online classes when, you know, for people who live maybe in smaller cities where we might not have the in-person classes.
Yeah. Hey, this has been great. Again, it's Luis, L-U-I-S, Minero, M-I-N-E-R-O. And you just go online and Google him, and you won't have any trouble finding him. Thank you so much for being with us, Luis. It's been a great fun. I could have talked to you for hours more.
Yes, indeed. No, thank you. Thank you, David, for the opportunity. And we hope that, you know, I hope that it, not only has it been useful, but, you know, that people can find out more information about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be hosted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website, and I'll publish those answers as well. Also, I cover all these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit, having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.